This week on Your Western Context, the Federal Court of Appeal quashes the Trans Mountain Pipeline. What does this mean for Alberta, BC, and the Canadian economy? BC also projects a surprising surplus due to the housing sector, and we go over the current state of NAFTA negotiations. This is Western Context, Episode 83, recorded Saturday, September 1st, 2018. No freebies in trade. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in, as we are each and every weekend. Welcome back to new and old listeners.
Indeed. Welcome back to all of our listeners who have stuck with us for quite a while, and for those who are just joining us for the first time, of course. We're now into September, which means people are heading back to school, summer is coming to a close, and other things are certainly coming to a close as well, with lots of things going on in the news this week. Some very big stories coming out that we definitely will be talking about.
That's true. And, you know, before we begin, you know, September 1st is a day that kind of signals the unofficial start of the fall season. You know, there's already some leaves starting to turn colors around here. But along with that, September 1st, 1905 is the day that Alberta became a province. And, you know, if that didn't happen, if that act of confederation didn't happen, we wouldn't be here talking about this today on a national podcast. And that's one of the reasons why we're here, is because of that act of confederation back in 1905. So if you're joining us for the first time, basically what Western Context is we're a podcast where we gather each and every week, and what we aim to do is remove the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media and the news, and put you guys on the right side of the news by providing all the information and context necessary to do so. And this is one of those weeks where we definitely need to do that. So what are we starting with?
Well, I think we're starting off with what would normally be the biggest story of the week, but it turns out there is actually one even bigger than this one. But nevertheless, we start with the Trans Mountain defeat, and the headline reads, Trans Mountain defeat threatens Justin Trudeau's re-election story. So on Thursday, there was a critical federal court of appeal ruling on the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion. Now, this was brought about by court challenges by some First Nations in BC. The Federal Court of Appeal quashed approval of the $9.3 billion Trans Mountain oil pipeline expansion on two grounds. First, the court found that Canada had inadequate consultation with First Nations at the final stage, concluding that Ottawa had, quote, failed to engage dialogue meaningfully and grapple with the real concerns of the Indigenous applicants so as to explore possible accommodation of those concerns. Second, the court found that the scope of their review unjustifiably did not include project-related tanker traffic, even though the National Energy Board was legally obligated to consider environmental effects. The court ruled that, quote, the unjustified exclusion of project-related marine shipping from the definition of the project rendered the board's report impermissibly flawed. So that's pretty strong language coming down from the court there. And basically, it ends up that it came down to a lack of First Nations consultation, despite many bands along the route supporting construction and the jobs and revenue that would come along with it, as well as a lack of review of increased tanker traffic, which most would have expected that the government would include, considering that's what most of the protests have been about. So the decision and the federal government's failure is now leaving construction workers, Alberta oil patch workers, refineries, and Canadian taxpayers as a whole in the lurch. Well, yeah. If you're learning about this story for the first time, you might be thinking, well, why do all Canadian taxpayers have to worry about this? And that's because the federal government, of course, bought it back a while ago for $4.5 billion. And that's going to be a major stumbling block with this, considering that they have bought the existing pipeline and the expansion, and now they can't expand it at all. So the federal government was confident that they had done enough to secure the win in the legal battle, but that was clearly not the case. Less than 48 hours before the legal decision on the pipeline. Federal Natural Resources Minister Amarjit Sohi sat back in a chair in a Calgary coffee shop feeling confident. He said that the Ottawa had done its adequate work communicating with Indigenous communities about a project the federal government deemed it was in the national interest. And this, of course, being the one that they bought for $4.5 billion. He said, quote, "We are very confident that we have done extensive consultation. We went beyond what the NAB has done. We took 6 months extra to consult with Indigenous communities and affected communities along the route. I think that puts us in a very strong position." So he said this on Tuesday. However, the Federal Court of Appeal ended up nullifying the permit for the $7.4 billion expansion project on the two grounds, of course, the consultation with Indigenous communities and the consideration of oil tanker traffic. Now, on Friday, the day after the ruling, the National Energy Board ordered construction work on the development to stop in the wake of the landmark ruling. So it's not just that the Natural Resources Minister was wrong, but it's also the broader question of what comes next for Canada's energy industry. Now, workers and companies who are set to be employed on the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion have been left wondering where they stand as construction on the project begins to shut down. Ryan Bruce, who is the Director of Government and Public Relations for the Union CLAC, said that some of the workers were sent home after the Court of Appeal ruling, and the workers will come back for a meeting with their employers early next week to talk about the next step as the situation unfolds. He said that construction on parts of the western end of the pipeline began 3 days ago, but it was stopped after the ruling was handed down. Official layoff notices have not been issued yet, but we're waiting to hear what happens next week, he said. Our members were happy to be working. They were expecting long-term employment on the project and to wake up Thursday morning and hear the news on the radio. That the decision came down the way it did was a surprise to all of us. Now, when the government, the federal government added an extra process onto the project's regulatory review designed specifically to increase Indigenous engagement, many onlookers thought that that would meet the consultation litmus test. It quite clearly didn't. And while the issue of marine safety was discussed within the NAB's report, the process wasn't deemed to be proper, creating a critical error that rendered the report fatally flawed, according to the court. Now, Chris Bloomer, CEO of the Canada Energy Pipeline Association, was dismayed by the decision. He said, quote, "We're sitting here thinking, what more needs to be done here? But this points out a really big problem. It's another kick in the pants for the industry and Canada's competitiveness. The government now, because they both own the project and own the process, they need to look about how they're going to address the issue." So as in the Northern Gateway court decision, it's worth pointing out the fatal mistakes here weren't made by the companies or the affected communities on either side of the pipeline divide. The fault lies squarely in the hands of federal governments, which have made the regulatory process so excessively complicated and cumbersome that no one, including the government itself, is apparently able to get a project in the national interest across the finish line. Now, BC Premier John Horgan, for quite a long time now, has opposed the Trans Mountain Pipeline. He applauded the court's decision. Speaking at a short press conference in Victoria, Horgan said that the case has always been about First Nations rights and the assertion by the Sewil Wataouth that the National Energy Board process was flawed and did not take into consideration their rights and title. Horgan said BC entered this appeal late in the day after being sworn in last summer, and, quote, "We did so to support the Sewil Wataouth, but also when you're an intervener, of course, you have to add to the argument." Horgan said that his government put forth the arguments in good faith, and though they, quote, "they were not supported today by the Supreme Court, the substance of the case was." What that means for BC, he furthered, is that our coast is considered to be an integral part of the decision-making process, and that marine traffic was not adequately assessed by the NAB or by the ordering council to proceed with Kinder Morgan. He said that today's decision is a great day for the Sewil Wataouth, and that those in BC who have been saying for many years that now that the NAB process was flawed and that the consequences of a spill were significant have been vindicated. He was asked if Project was dead in his mind. He replied that certainly it's something that will be no longer on the top of mind for most British Columbians. He then went on to say that they'll be able to focus on the things that their citizens want most of the focus to be on: housing, affordability, and making sure that we're creating jobs for skilled training positions for the next generation of workers. Which, you know, as we saw here earlier, they're clearly not creating jobs in this particular sector. Now, as for BC's relations with neighboring Alberta, which boiled over into a mini trade war last spring, in large part due to BC's threat to try and restrict bitumen flows, Horgan says that he believes Alberta will acknowledge the ruling and is well within its rights to appeal. He added that he's sensitive to Alberta's feeling about the projects, but that his focus remains west of the Rockies. He said, "Certainly I understand that this is going to be a devastating decision for many in Alberta, and I respect that, but my responsibility is the people of BC, and our position is that the marine environment is part and parcel of our vibrant economy, and it wasn't considered by the previous federal government and wasn't given due consideration by the current government." So in the end, it basically all comes back to Trudeau and the federal government itself. In 2015, he promised that Canadians would have the environmental back of the partnership with communities that host new pipeline developments. He also vowed to establish a real partnership with First Nations, and the Federal Court of Appeal, of course, found that they didn't. And the only interprovincial pipeline project that they were able to approve has fallen short on both accounts. So it's not just Trudeau's political capital with the First Nations that took another hit this week. It's also his capacity to advance his environmental agenda. Now, the federal climate change framework now hangs by a thread that could be cut in next year's election. So one can't help but think that Trudeau is at least fortunate in that he will be facing rookie New Democrat and Conservative leaders in Jagmeet Singh and Andrew Scheer next year, rather than the battle-tested Thomas Mulcair and Stephen Harper on this issue. However, it will still be a tough fight, and that all comes down to the federal government's failure on building pipelines.
And I think that last sentence there describes this in entirety. Failure. When you look at this, this is a project that should have been a shoo-in. It was one that was approved by the National Energy Board. And at any point in time, when you have a court system that is, for by all accounts in Canada, you know, unaccountable to the people because they're not elected, they're appointed, and you know, there's no way for everyday Canadians to have their own opinions in what happens with the courts. When you have courts determining policy in this country, whether it's, you know, whether this pipeline gets built or even what the Supreme Court did with the Assisted Suicide Act to enable legal euthanasia back in 2015, the courts in this country now have, you know, numerous cases where they have been able to make policy in one way or another. And I think that's something that wasn't talked about in this story at all, is that this project and others in the future are going to be put to the same test where they have to go up against the courts. And the courts are, of course, you know, they're being encouraged by activists and whatnot. And when you have a government that is going to be facing re-election in, you know, 3 years if they're just getting started, or next year in the case of Trudeau here, you know, you just have to wonder what motivation does that government have to go up against the courts and change the way the courts work, change the way the system works, so that if a project is approved by the government, if the companies that own the land want to do something on the land, they should very well be able to do so and not be subject to court cases from across the entire country on this. That's point number one. Point number two on this is that, you know, if you listen to John Horgan, Justin Trudeau, and even Premier Rachel Notley on this, they'll say that part of this, specifically the coastal side, goes back to the Harper government, and in that, you know, the Harper government made it so that the NEB didn't need to consider marine traffic, marine coastal traffic, when looking at a project. And, you know, that's half of this dispute here. The other half is with the Indigenous groups who don't support it along the line. And, you know, we've talked about that before on the podcast. There are Indigenous groups and entire ones along this route that do indeed support this pipeline. So, you know, just painting all the Indigenous groups along this pipeline as not supporting it is bad, and that's been happening in the media as well with this. But also, when it comes to the coastal issues, if that was going to be a problem going forward, why didn't the government know this in 2016 when they began on this project?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is something that was not new. This is what almost the entirety of the BC government, as well as all the protesters in Burnaby, have been protesting over, is not the pipe, not much of the pipeline itself, but the tanker traffic and the possibility of spills into the ocean and the waterways in between Vancouver Island and the mainland. And this is something that's been going on forever. So this is not something new. And I think everyone just assumed that the federal government was doing their due diligence on this matter when it's quite clear that, for the better part of 3 years since they were elected, they have not.
Yeah,
And
and you
that
know,
all comes back to them.
it's a poison pill as well, because we've heard many times from Justin Trudeau and Gerald Butts that they have wanted a tanker moratorium on the West Coast. And what is one way to get a tanker moratorium other than having one of these pipelines fail this test, right? So
Is to get the courts to rule against it.
exactly. So it's a, it it it's you know it's when you look at it, it's a really interesting mental exercise here, because the media isn't talking about it in this way. But what's actually happened here is the courts have given this government exactly what they wanted, and probably John Horgan exactly what they wanted as well, what they could only dream they could do in legislation, and that's create a tanker moratorium on the West Coast with this. And here we are. So it's really unfortunate, because this basically means here for Canada that we're at a point where you can have a project that is all but approved. The land has been acquired by the respective parties, but even if you own that land, even if you consult with the federal government, you get the right zoning, you get the right legislation in place, you can't do anything with that land. And one thing that this is saying, and it's this is not what we want to be broadcasting to the world this week. We'll get to that in firing line, but you don't want to be broadcasting to the world this week that Canada is a hard place to invest in and to have your money grow and do something with it, because there are many other jurisdictions that produce oil and gas that have far less restrictions than we're seeing this week. And we've long talked about before that anytime something comes in with the economy isn't necessarily all about policies, interest rates, and taxes. It's also about psychological feeling. Do investors and people with money feel that it's a healthy decision, a decision that will allow them to grow their portfolio, to invest that money in Western Canada, in the oil industry? And if they don't feel that, they're going to take that money elsewhere, and that's going to hurt our GDP. And we could already be on that path later on in the show this week on the firing line segment, but we'll get to that later, of course. Go
I
ahead.
think one final note on this as well is that this decision and pitting governments against each other just furthers erodes the national Canadian unity as well, in that if you can't trust the federal government to do its due diligence on, something that's so simple that as, being able to environmentally approve a pipeline, it makes you wonder what exactly they're there for and how they're able to represent us. And when there's such infighting between governments and that we haven't seen the like of in the past, especially among the Western
It hasn't
provinces
been
as
this
well,
bad since the 90s.
it creates an erosion of the national identity, the Canadian identity, and it also means that, Canada as a whole, we can't even stand up with one voice against the rest of the world as well, because we've got so much infighting. And that's something that to be concerned about as well, especially given what we're going to be talking about later, is that Canada can't even, we can't even agree on things that are happening within our own country. How are we going to agree, and be able to put up a tough front to the rest of the world?
Exactly. And when you're looking at it from this perspective as well, you look at other oil producing nations like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia and even Russia. And when you have a situation like this, and you have Canada not even able to agree internally on what's going on, you got to wonder what those countries are thinking as well. And when you think about it, it's actually kind of embarrassing to think that we need to be thinking about that in this day and age. And that's specifically why I mentioned Confederation of Alberta, is because back in 1905, the idea of confederation was to speak as one voice and to do things as a country. But obviously, we're not doing that in this case today with this pipeline decision. Now, I want to take this story over to the Alberta side of it now, because, of course, Alberta is the major player and perhaps the biggest player in this, and who's going to feel the most out of it, the actions of Justin Trudeau and the courts and the like. So on Thursday, Premier Rachel Notley actually had a televised address to the province and a press conference following it, where she basically responded to this. And, you know, this is perhaps some of the most stern language that we have ever heard from the Premier on this. She basically said that the time for Canadian niceties is over, and without Alberta, that plan, the climate plan, isn't worth the paper it's written on. And with this, she had said that Alberta is actually leaving the federal climate plan that Justin Trudeau has put in place until, quote, the federal government gets its act together. And when you think about it, that is a pretty big statement from the NDP Premier of Alberta to Justin Trudeau, who for the longest time has been one of Justin Trudeau's allies on the environmental front. So you might be wondering, what does the Premier have to say about this and what does she want? Well, most of what she wants is geared towards the federal government. She wants an emergency session of Parliament to fix the NEB consultation process. And this would fix what we were just talking about, the courts and talking about tanker traffic and the NEB not consulting on that. She wants an emergency session so that that can be fixed very quickly and so that the NEB can get their work going once again on approving this project once more. She also wants construction to still begin in 2019. She feels it can begin in 2019 if quick steps are taken. But let's be real here, courts move very, very slowly. And based on what we've heard from Justin Trudeau and what Justin Trudeau and the federal government is busy with this week, we're unlikely to see that emergency session of Parliament until the fall session actually begins. So I think it's safe to say at this point that 2019 construction on the pipeline will not be happening. Now, also, Jason Kenney, leader of the United Conservative Party opposition, with this, called the news devastating for workers, and he wants the premier to withdraw the carbon tax that would supposedly get these pipelines built. And when the premier came out that January 2016 morning and basically said it was on a Sunday, and you know you announce news on Sundays that you don't want to get that much coverage, he basically said that the province was bringing in this carbon tax so that it would get us the social license to build pipelines. And obviously, pipelines haven't been built with this, and the carbon tax wasn't campaigned on. So that's, of course, one of the shots that Jason Kenney has taken at the premier on this. And this was one of the only shots he took at the premier on this because, I mean, let's be real at this point with this project and what this means for the government in Alberta. The Premier Notley and the NDP have effectively hinged any re-election hope they have on getting this pipeline built, because their saying was that if we can build pipelines and we show the rest of the country that we have this carbon tax and we're looking out for our environment, then yes, if we get the pipeline built, the economy will start doing better and people will vote for us again. But without a pipeline, there is no central re-election platform for the current NDP government on this. And, you know, this was in large part the general sentiment across the political talking headspace here in Alberta. Anywhere you look, from Global to even Graham Thompson in the Edmonton Journal this week, I believe it was Graham Thompson, actually said that the only thing getting buried next spring could potentially be the NDP government in Alberta. So, I mean, to have even the Edmonton Journal come to that realization on this project, that means that this is really, really bad for this government. And the sad fact of the matter is there's nothing that the provincial government can do here on this, because it is, by all in parts, a current federal government problem. And speaking of that, I just want to pivot a little bit to what Bill Morneau had to say on this. And he said, our government remains committed to ensuring the project proceeds in a manner that protects the public interest, whatever that means. I mean, protecting the public interest at this point probably just means ensuring that the laws are followed and they're able to get the project built after making the necessary changes, though on what timeline, we don't know. And like we said earlier in the part of the story here, it's a $4.5 billion pipeline project, and well, We own that now. We can't expand it. So that's another issue that really hasn't been talked about that much in the media. And when you think about it, it is one of the biggest issues going forward with this. And, you know, there's questions about this too. You know, will the federal government actually appeal this to the Supreme Court, and will it happen, you know, by the end of September or sooner even? And if not, you have to ask what is actually happening with this. And if they don't do it, well, that could be another litmus test for the federal government. And going back to Alberta, what does it actually mean to pull out of the federal climate plan? Well, quite frankly, not that much, because Alberta's carbon tax is staying in place. The federal climate plan would have ensured that the Alberta carbon tax would have went up in 2022, but by pulling out of that, that won't happen if that plan is even to still exist at this point, because, you know, you have Alberta now against it, and what else do we have? Saskatchewan, Ontario. I think it was Newfoundland that's also against it. So really not many provinces are supporting the climate plan anymore.
Even Nova Scotia, one of the Liberal premiers there that has supported it ever since the beginning, is now concerned that the carbon tax is going to hit them more disproportionately, even though their carbon levels, their emission levels, have actually been reduced since the 1990s. So they've actually done their work when it comes to the environment in Nova Scotia, and they're actually complaining that the carbon tax is now going to be hitting them more than other provinces per capita. So they're actually having concerns about it as well. So not just the conservative governments in Canada, but the Liberal ones as well are also having concerns with Trudeau's carbon tax. So you're very right in the fact that when we talked about this a couple weeks ago at the Premier's meeting in Nova Scotia, that there was a lot of concern about the carbon tax. And I think this decision by Alberta has definitely left it in limbo.
Yeah, I mean, it's an NDP government in Alberta saying this. So you can only imagine what other potential governments in Alberta would say about this as well. And, you know, as I said going into this segment, it puts a black mark on investment in Canada. No one is going to invest huge proportionate amounts of money that are needed to get an economy going in Canada if they see that their money will get stuck up in a system that is controlled by the courts. It speaks of a federal approval process that is broken, a federal environmental process that is broken, and more importantly, a federal resource-based economy that is broken because of the courts and the systems that we have all just been talking about. You know, we have this resource economy. It needs to be developed. But if the courts are going to hold it hostage, I don't know what else there is to say on this, except the fact that there needs to be radical changes made to the top-level systems in this country.
Yeah, and I think beyond that as well, not just the processes that are broken, but that the federal Liberal government bought the pipeline and bought the expansion process. So they bought it for $4.5 billion, but they also are on the hook for a lot more billions of dollars beyond that to actually pay for the expansion process that's now not going to be working as well. So it's going to be leaving taxpayers in the lurch, because this is all coming down to the government's revenue and their deficits. And we're still running government deficits, and this going on to it is definitely not going to help. And the fact that they can't even expand their own pipeline, that's also quite troublesome for the federal government as well.
It's like someone buying a new gazebo for their backyard, and the neighbor telling them that, oh, you can't put that gazebo up, it's blocking my son. That this is effectively what's happening here.
Yeah, it's not even that. It's basically you buying a new car and then finding that you don't have an engine in it, and that you have to buy the engine, but the engine itself doesn't work for that car, because it has to go through regulatory consultations with your neighbors, and some of them approve it and some of them don't, and it turns out that the court rules that you can't actually put that engine in that car, so you can't actually drive it. So now you own a car that can't move. That's more like what it is. And the fact that the government let this happen, did all the consultations that they said they were going to do, but clearly failed on quite a bit of it, and didn't do the reviews that they were supposed to do on this as well, it's absolutely shameful. And I think I don't know if there's anything more we can say on it than that.
No, there's not. But I'll tell you about something that isn't shameful. If you want to support this podcast, you can have a look at our support page. That's not shameful. You can find that at westerncontext.ca/support. We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext, and we offer 3 tiers of support. For $2 a month, which is the price of a cup of coffee, you'll help us to continue to remove this bias and sensationalism that you find in the news and media. And if you want to take it up to $5 a month, which is effectively the price of a sandwich, you'll continue to help us do that, but you can also have your name read out on the podcast if you so desire. And for $10 a month, you become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain access to pre-release show notes. So you might be wondering, what will we do with this? Well, if we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll do a bi-monthly news and review podcast where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide our opinion on where the affairs may be headed next. And if we reach $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. So you can find out more about this at westerncontext.ca/support or patreon.com/westerncontext. We also have an option to make a one-time donation via PayPal, which you can do at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, what do we got for BC?
So, with our BC story this week being slightly less big than the previous one, of course, it was talking about the BC budget and how they were able to maintain their budget surplus despite ICBC losses and wildfire spending. So, BC government delivered surprising news on Tuesday last week in the form of another budget surplus for the 2017-18 fiscal year ending March 31st. Finance Minister Carol James announced the $301 million surplus in the year-end financial figures on a $51.7 billion budget. So when you factor in the extra $3 billion spent on government and social programs, as well as costs for the devastating 2017 wildfires, there was not really expected to be a surplus, but it appears that through creative accounting, the NDP has somehow managed it. So most of what made up the expected shortfall was actually an increase in revenue from the real estate market and the lucrative property taxes that go along with it. Though it may be the last time that the housing sector delivers such a surprise cash windfall to the provincial treasury. The property transfer tax accounted for more than $2.1 billion in revenue, which is $266 million more than the government was expecting. It also includes extra revenue generated after February 21st, when the government expanded the foreign buyer tax to 20% and increased property transfer taxes on homes valued at more than $3 million. However, it's quite well known, and we've been talking about this for quite a while now, that this unexpected revenue source won't last. New figures on the slowdown will be released in September as part of the quarterly update to the current year's 2018-19 budget. Home sales in Metro Vancouver in July were at their lowest level in 18 years, and some realtors believe that a significant decline in prices is quietly occurring in the market. Jock Finlayson, who is the executive vice president for the Business Council of BC, preaches caution. He says, obviously, we're coming off the boil from the housing real estate boom. That's clearly an area where the slowdown is very much in evidence in the Lower Mainland and to some extent in the province as well in sales activity. It's going to pinch the government's revenues for sure. Some of that, I think, they factored into their budget in February. The real question is whether what's happening now is a bigger downturn than what was predicted in the budget. And I think that's something that should be mentioned as well, is that this downturn that's happening with the real estate market, is the NDP government going to be factoring this in when it comes to their next budget as well? Because if they're not factoring that downturn in with their revenues, we're going to be very quickly finding that surplus that we have had for quite some time is going to be very quickly turned into a deficit if they keep up their spending. Now, the year-end financial figures showed a $1.3 billion loss by the Insurance Corporation of BC, otherwise known as ICBC, which the NDP has attempted to plug by instituting a cap on pain and suffering claims for minor injuries and an overhaul of insurance penalties for bad drivers. James said that the government also made a $950 million adjustment to its finances to address concerns that Independent Auditor General Carol Bellringer made about BC Hydro's use of deferral accounts that push off expenses into future years. Hydro has $4.5 billion in deferral accounts remaining even after the change. The dispute with the auditor over BC Hydro's finances delayed the release of public accounts by more than a month. Carol James herself acknowledged that, quote, "Normally, I would have been standing here in July, but our ministry needed the extra time to work with the Office of the Auditor General because of some of the challenges with BC Hydro's deferral accounts." Now, debt was measured at just under 16% as a share of GDP and 83% as a share of annual government revenues. Both measures were good enough to maintain that vaunted AAA credit rating that was inherited by the BC Liberals. However, the New Democrats may be challenged to live up to these results going forward. As we said before, the first read on the current financial year is due in a couple weeks and may well show some very discouraging developments on the spending side because of, you know, not just the wildfires from last year, but the wildfires that are currently happening as we speak, as well as, you know, downturns in the housing and the real estate sector. So when revenues inevitably decrease, it will be up to the government to show prudence and allow us to stay within the balanced budget by reining in their government spending.
And, you know, one thing that actually, two things that jump out about this for me. The first thing local to BC on this is that, you know, we have heard many times that people have said that, oh, the housing issue and, you know, putting the speculation taxes on the real estate in the Lower Mainland and Vancouver Island and such like that. It's not really an issue. You're being xenophobic by putting those taxes on. Well, as we can see here, the government is raking it in from those taxes. So that's point number one. It really just shows what the level of housing issues were in BC before that tax would have been put in place. And I don't know. I think this is probably a good thing for the New Democrats to be taking advantage of the speculation tax on that front. Yes.
Yeah, well, it certainly looks really good for them that they're posting a surplus when they really weren't expected to after all the spending that they've done. But it comes down to how they got that surplus,
right,
of course. And the way that they're getting that surplus is because of the real estate market and the money that they've made on the extra taxes that they've put on it. So it really comes down to that. And when housing prices decrease, which all of the government taxes say they will, all the revenue is going to decrease as well, and that's going to leave questions as to where that extra revenue is going to go and where we're going to make up for that in if we want to keep running a surplus, which by all accounts we definitely do.
Yeah, and the second part of this is, you know, the creative accounting. That's nothing new for governments. I know the former Progressive Conservative government here in Alberta did that as well to make it look like the budgetary situation wasn't necessarily as bad as it is, and you had to delve deep into these reports, and it often wasn't reported in the media what was happening with this. So it's definitely a good catch to see that, you know, the surplus in BC is just being held up by this one pillar. And yes, that is indeed creative accounting going forward. And it just raises that extra little level of caution going forth about, you know, whether there's too much spending or whether there needs to be more revenue brought in. And I'll also just say at the end of the day, the fact that BC remains having a AAA credit rating is good for you guys with the debt and the like as well. The same can't be said for the government here in Alberta that has indeed suffered credit rating decreases in the past. So I'd say that, you know, as much as we have criticized the BC NDP before for their fiscal plans, this is actually a decent budget for BC, except for the fact it was done in a little bit shady way of reporting.
Yes, I agree. I think that the reporting on this issue really didn't cover all of the facts on this, and you kind of have to look at half a dozen articles on the issue as I did and try and put all the pieces together, because each one has a certain piece of the puzzle, but they don't actually all talk about what it actually is. And I think you're absolutely correct in that this looks really good for the BCNDP, because, you know, they're posting a surplus, they still have their AAA credit rating, so it kind of allows them to be a bit smug when it refers, when they refer to other provinces. They almost can look at their economy and say, well, look at us, we're the NDP, we spend more and we still have a surplus. So it really makes it hard to criticize them for their detractors on different things, when especially the media is so focused on being positive for them as well, and not actually delving into why the surplus is actually there to begin with.
And let's be real here. What normal person is going to go through the, you know, 100-page plus budget documents that provinces put out to actually find these details? So they're at the mercy of the media, and we find the data for you guys, and you guys get it from this podcast in a way that's presented a little bit better than the mainstream media does, let's say. So,
indeed.
All right, so that takes us into our firing line segment, and that is, of course, the story that hasn't been talked about nearly enough, or is just downright insane, and we're definitely in the downright insane category this week with this one. And this pertains to, well, the NAFTA negotiations in the United States, and in particular on Monday, this shocked everyone. A story broke that said that Trump announces U.S.-Mexico trade deal to replace NAFTA. So the question with that is, what about Canada? Where's Canada in this? Well, at the time, Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland was in Ukraine. She rushed home overnight and was in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday to begin negotiations again. So in a joint telephone press conference with the Mexican president, President Trump said, "We will see," when asked if Canada could be a part of the deal. So it's there's a big if about if Canada will be a part of the deal and what Canada's role in particular will be on this deal. And, you know, it's something that Canada definitely wants and needs if you just look at how the economies are intertwined. Following this, it was said that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had a constructive conversation with Donald Trump on Monday afternoon, and a Friday deal or Friday deadline was set in place to sign the deal. But the deadline came and went with intention to continue negotiations after the holiday weekend is up, because it is also Labor Day weekend in the United States this weekend, just as it is Labor Day weekend here in Canada. So the threat of auto tariffs has been looming over the deal, and, you know, President Trump with this, he said that it would just be easier to apply auto tariffs than working out an agreement with Canada. And it's been rumored to say that every time the Canadian officials have been difficult when it came to these negotiations, that his negotiating team would just hold up a picture of a Chevy Impala. Because, of course, the Chevy Impala is one of the cars that is produced in Oshawa, Ontario. And if that's to be imported into the U.S., well, that would have tariffs placed on it. And that would, of course, hurt the Canadian economy. So you might be wondering, how did we get to this point? Because there'd been no trilateral negotiations with the U.S. and Mexico for weeks. And trilateral basically means that all three parties would have been negotiating on the deal together. It was, I believe, 5 or 6 weeks since there had been any negotiations on the matter. So it was only when rumblings were heard through the press that Chrystia Freeland and Justin Trudeau's prime advisor, Gerald Butts, actually headed to Washington to start up negotiations again on Tuesday. So the initial issue, as thought, during the G7 meeting earlier this year in Quebec was that it was the sunset clause. And at the time, there was apparently a deal that the U.S. had that was ready for Canada to be signed. And the issue with this is that there would have been a five-year sunset clause, a five-year renegotiation period in this. And that issue has been fixed as of this point, apparently. All countries have agreed to a 16-year term for the trade deal, with a review phase after 6 years to consider whether or not the deal should be renewed for another another 16 years. So after 6 years, that would make the total lifespan of this deal 32 years. Now, other areas that are holding up the negotiation process are rumored to be the Chapter 19 dispute mechanism. Now, you'd be forgiven if you haven't heard of this, because this is a part of NAFTA that directly affects producers on this. And basically what Chapter 19 is it allows for companies that feel their products have been hit unfairly with anti-dumping or countervailing duties at the border to request arbitration by a third party. The United States wants this entire section scrapped. Canada is very reluctant to do that. Last we heard, Canada was willing to go and have a third party look at these Chapter 19 disputes. They're not willing to scrap this entirely. That's rumored to be one current stumbling block on this. The U.S. still also wants our supply management system to change. And basically, if you've been living under a rock or you're just joining us on this podcast for the first time, supply management is Canada's dairy cartel that basically ensures that Canada's dairy farmers are protected and that it makes it a lot harder for other countries to sell dairy into Canada. And it also sets quotas and prices for the dairy industry in Canada. But as an olive branch on this, the Canadians have reportedly offered more access to the Americans into the Canadian dairy sector without compromising supply management. And what this would effectively do is it would allow Wisconsin dairy farmers to sell their heavy milk that they use to make cheese into Canada on this. So that's definitely one thing that is rumored to be happening on this. But quite frankly, this might not be enough, because we don't know what a dollar value associated with this would be. And it still won't be tariff-free, because the supply management system will exist, and it won't provide the total and open access to our dairy industry as the U.S. has requested. And, you know, if you look up free trade, you would find that free trade implies zero or almost zero tariff. But quite frankly, the supply management system is a tariff-based protection mechanism. So a summary of what we have here. This is a deal that Canada should, by all means, sign on to if it can be made fair, though given how long it's taken for us to get to that point, that's not even certain if it will be fair for Canada at this point, because the deal so far that has currently been presented has largely been negotiated bilaterally with just U.S. and Mexico. They have negotiated together on various aspects of it, and Canada has now been invited to come in and negotiate after the fact on sections that are specific to Canada. So it certainly feels as though that Canada no longer has a competitive edge in these negotiations. We no longer have the sharpest sword in the tool shed, so to speak. And we're left to fix these sticking out points for Canada. And it's at our peril to attempt to get what's best for our country out of these negotiations in an arbitrary time limitation that has been put into place. And you might be wondering, what is the arbitrary time limitation? Well, there is a time limitation of Friday that was put into place, but we know they're going to go into next week. But the U.S. administration has also served notice to Congress, which is their equivalent of our House of Commons, that they'll be bringing a trade deal forward to be ratified. And in the United States, any trade deal or treaty must go through Congress to get ratification and become the official law of the land. And the wording that was used on this said that the U.S. intends to enter into a trade deal with Mexico and Canada if they are willing. So it very much spells out the language that it's up to Canada now to negotiate the sticking out points on this. And that leads us to the view that perhaps we might not have the sharpest tool in the shed at this point. Now, this is largely because the U.S. wants to get the deal done before the midterm elections in November, but also that Mexico wants it concluded because the current Mexican president leaves office on December 1st. Now, as of Friday, Canada has made no concessions on dairy access, and these were, of course, the headlines of Friday afternoon and speak volumes going into these final negotiations. If no concessions are going to be made, then it's highly unlikely that we'll be able to make a deal, because let's just think about this. What else does Canada have to offer at this point? Not much. Now, Andrew Scheer, the conservative opposition leader here, spoke bluntly on the issue after being criticized by Maxime Bernier and others on the right, he basically said on Twitter, "At this critical time in the NAFTA negotiations, it has become clear that Mexico and the U.S. have come to major agreements while Canada was not even at the table. It is unacceptable that Canada has been presented with a take-it-or-leave-it deal on major aspects of this deal. Canadians I've spoken to are frustrated that Mexico and the U.S. struck this deal behind Trudeau's back. They want to know why Canada is on the outside looking in, while major sectors of the economy and millions of jobs hang in the balance. As always, conservatives are ready and willing to assist the government. Over 1 in 5 jobs depend on trade in the U.S., and conservative MPs will do everything we can to ensure that our trading relationship with our NAFTA partners is protected." So that's one side of the story that was talked about this week. And, you know, credit to Andrew Scheer for coming out and saying what needed to be said on the issue, because I think for far too long, and, you know, they are trying to present a united front against the Americans and the Mexicans on this issue, but there are things, hard things, that need to be said, and they're starting to be said. Now, on Friday, it was also published in the Toronto Star that Donald Trump issued a series of scathing remarks over the current trade negotiations and their process in place. And basically, what happened at this point in time is that when it came down to it at the end of the day, Trump reportedly told Bloomberg that he would not be making any concessions with Canada, but he could not say this publicly because it's going to be so insulting that they're not going to be able to make a deal. Trump later confirmed these words in a tweet saying, "Wow, I made off-the-record comments to Bloomberg concerning Canada, and this powerful understanding was blatantly violated. Oh well, just more dishonest reporting. I'm used to it. At least Canada knows where I stand." The Canadian media jumped on this story and covered it right away with such rigor that it initially looked to be quite suspicious. So here's our thoughts on the matter. First, Trump likely told this to Bloomberg, knowing full well it would be leaked. And secondly, this furthers Trump's cause of the Trump's case against the dishonest media in the United States, as he has been talking about since 2015. And number three, the media here in Canada jumped on this because they're so eager for a Trump-Trudeau fight going into the 2019 election on any matter that they'll do anything to advance it. And when you think about it, that is likely related to the media ratings today. And you have to ask the question, should the media be pushing this given the current state of what's happening with the Canadian economy, the pipeline, NAFTA, trade deals, and the like? Because in the meantime, NAFTA, quite frankly, hangs in the balance.
And I think this is just another story that we can just hang squarely on the federal government and Trudeau as well, because it's quite clear this has been going on for quite some time, and that, you know, all of the stuff in this story, much like the Trans Mountain Pipeline, none of it is really new. We kind of knew all of the different things that have been going on with this, where the sticking points are, apparently, a lot of the stuff to go on with the dairy. And it seems like the federal government is sticking to it here, even though Mexico was able to compromise and get a deal. Canada might leave themselves without a deal. And when you're dealing with a country that's bordering with you, that has you share the longest land border in the world with, and when your economy depends so heavily on the United States, it's quite frankly amazing that we simply aren't able to make a deal on that.
What exactly is this? Because at the end of the day, this is perhaps the biggest trade deal that Canada is involved in. And if it's not going successfully, the pipeline's not going successfully, that just speaks volumes to what's going on in Ottawa.
Yeah, and what's going on with our economy as well, because so much of our economy does rely on the natural resource sector, and a lot of it relies on our trade relationship with the United States. You think of all of the trading that goes on, not just in the lower border with Canada as well, but also the border with Alaska and the maritime borders as well. And if we're not able to successfully negotiate with the United States, which is, you know, one of our major allies, what does this say for the negotiating tactics with other trade deals as well, with ones that are reportedly happening with the EU and with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and what's going on there? So it's almost part of a larger deal as with what it just raises more questions as to what our federal government is actually doing to help Canada and what they have been able to do to further their own agenda since they've taken power in 2015. It remains to see what they've actually done since then.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a time and a place for criticism of the government on this matter. But at the end of the day, we need to remember that it's the economy at stake. So we want them to get this right. And, you know, if this doesn't go right, if the pipeline doesn't go right, I think that combined with the immigration file has already, you know, many months out just defined the 2019 election campaign.
Yeah, exactly. It's these major issues that the federal government hasn't been able to work on and that they haven't been able to make progress on. It all comes down to how the media is going to report it. And it seems like, as you said, that they want to have a Trump-Trudeau fight going into 2019, that they'll do anything to advance it. And that seems to be the case from what we see in all of the reporting on NAFTA, is that, you know, they're antagonizing the American negotiators on this deal, and they're, you know, trying to pump up the federal government on this as well, when it's really clear that the federal government is, you know, there's quite a few sticking points from them as well. So it, you know, when you have to make a trade deal, there's two different parties and you have to come to an agreement, and it's quite clear that there's no agreement here. And, you know, as you said, NAFTA is going to hang in the balance, and we'll have to just wait and see what happens with this, as we do with all things.
Indeed. And, you know, it's quite unfortunate that we had two of these huge stories this week that can potentially affect the Canadian economy on that. But at the end of the day, it's the government and they need to make this right. And, you know, before we wrap this up, we'll do our usual word of the week. And our word of the week is freebie, because something given free of charge, a gift or handout. And I think that it's quite clear at this point that we're not going to get a free ride on the pipeline. The pipeline is not going to be approved for free. And the NAFTA deal isn't going to be free of charge at this point as well. We're going to have to give something up, whether it's supply management or Chapter 19. There will be no freebies this week for the federal government.
And I think we can also extend that to the BC government as well, and that's nothing there is free as well. And eventually, when it comes down to their budget and what happens with their economy and how that moves forward with how they plan their spending, nothing is free there as well. And if you continue to spend, that's more of a negative. And if you don't have the revenue to make up for it, that causes problems as well. And when it comes to freebies as well, nothing is free, as we said, and I think that's something that we all have to keep in mind when it comes to things of the economy and with trading with the world, is that Canada, as a country, we have to stand united, because if we are fractured, it just means that the world governments are going to walk over us, and we can't let that happen.
That's right. And that wraps up this episode of Western Context. If you want full show notes, you can find them at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to us on any podcast listener, iTunes, Pocket Cast, Google Play, you name it. Find out how to do that at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on social media at Western Context on Twitter and Facebook. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll make sure to always check through all the sources that we find throughout the news this week, and to make sure that we cut through all that bias and sensationalism that we always see in the mainstream media, to make sure that you are being able to put yourself on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.